This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
With a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. And I'm going to go to my first guest pretty soon. Is he on the line yet, Ed? Okay, so when he gets on, we'll go straight to him. And after that, I'm going to have a interview with Lisa Gardner about her new book. It is a wonderful book. It's called Look For Me. And as I talk to her, I hope that perhaps you will then go to her website and have a look at it, because she has a very intriguing thing up there. And today is the release date for this new book. It's the ninth in her series, it's called Look For Me. So I will be talking to her. And I'm also expecting a call in from somebody who was on the program a while back, and I just so enjoyed talking to him, Coach Bob Slowick, and he's going to be calling in, and we're just going to chat a little bit. First of all, I want to thank him because for the first time, I looked at a Super Bowl game, and I understood a little bit about it because of his book, which is called 60 Minutes to a Lifetime, and I wanted to thank him for that and also to talk to him about what's going on with football in general. So I'm looking forward to talking to him. And in a few minutes, I should be getting my first call in. Meanwhile, I want to ask everyone, please go, when next time you are online, please go to my Facebook page, Radio Joy on Paper, and push that like button. And I need some likes in there. That is, as I have announced at the beginning of the year, that is my word for the year. Facebook, because I need to really work on Facebook, you know, both for authors and people on radio or anywhere, anybody out there, you have to do some things that are important, and so sometimes you neglect them. And I really had not spent much time on Facebook because I'm really busy, and I didn't realize how little I did on it until recently. And so I want everybody to help me and get those likes up there for me, because it'll help me. So I appreciate that. And I also want to thank several people have written in and told me how much they have enjoyed some of the recent programs that one of them, of course, was the Gretchen Rubin program. And we were talking about happiness, and the guest I'm going to have on in a little while is also going to be talking, well, he wrote a book about happiness, and today he's going to be talking about free will, so we'll see if that, how that relates to happiness. Anyway, it's still the beginning of the year, and if you haven't started writing your book, you still have 330 days, I think. So you could write a book with 330 pages if you just start writing one page a day, and that's it. That's all you need. And at the end, you'll have a nice novel for 330 pages, or maybe a biography or a memoir of your family. So sometimes you think, oh, I can't do it. But for most people, if you take an hour in a day, just set it aside and write that one page, and it's fun. You learn a lot about yourself as you're writing, and you learn a lot about what you don't know and what you need to know. So that is something that perhaps is your word for the year. Write. And as I said, my word is Facebook. So I appreciate anyone who goes to Facebook and likes my page. I also want to remind everyone, if there's still time to get into the Irene Goodman critique, the auction is still up, as I think it was still up yesterday, and you still have a chance to get into that, to get a critique from Irene Goodman, one of the top agents in New York City, and she will give you all the feedback that you need in order to understand where you are and what your writing requires and how you can improve yourself. So that's something you can do. And meanwhile, I'm just waiting. I think the phone is ringing in there. I love when Big Ed is on the line. And we're going to have in a few minutes a conversation with someone who has some interesting ideas about happiness and about free will. And so I'm just waiting for that. And meanwhile, again, also, you know, there's Twitter, too. I'm trying to do Twitter, Facebook, Twitter, everything. Now, okay, so now I have on the phone with me Dan Baker, who has written a book called Free Will Explained, How Science and Philosophy Converge to Create a Beautiful Illusion. Hi, Dan, are you there?
Hi, I'm here, and it's Dan Barker with an R.
Oh, I'm sorry, Bark.
Yeah.
Oh, well, you know.
Yeah, it was your free will to make that mistake.
I'm sorry about it. I don't know. My eyes. Yeah, okay. So, Barker, I'm sorry. So, Dan Barker, it's so nice to have you on. And as we said, this book, your new book, is called Free Will Explained. And so perhaps that's the best thing you could do. Explain to us, what is free will?
So, you know, people have been arguing for millennia, philosophers and scientists and theologians, and they all disagree with each other. Martin Luther disagreed with Aquinas. And when I was a Christian minister, I thought we had the free will to accept Jesus as our Savior. And you don't have to be an expert to notice that all the experts disagree about whether we have free will. It feels like we do. We all think we do. But there's been this debate between determinists, who are absolutely right, by the way. Scientifically, there's no such thing as free will. Everything, every decision you make was because of the laws of nature and the laws that we live with. But we are social animals. So in my book, Free Will Explained, I point out that this illusion that we feel like we could have done otherwise than what we actually did, this illusion is a very useful social illusion. Free will is not a scientific truth, but free will is a social truth. And so most philosophers think we can use the word free will, and most people on the street think we can use the word phrase free will. And even though we don't actually have ultimate free will in a scientific sense, we do have a very useful illusion, and that's in the title of my book. It's an illusion that's beautiful and it's useful, and we should refer to that illusion as a useful part of what it means to be a human being.
So by free will, it means people think that they can do whatever they want?
Yeah. Free will is this illusion of transcending the natural world. Like we're little gods or souls or spirits, or some philosophers talk about dualists. You know, we have this ability to kind of be controlling it from above somehow, when in fact your entire brain, your genetics, your makeup, your likes and your dislikes and your influences and your instincts, all of that was handed to you. You didn't create that. You're not deciding how the neurons are firing in your brain with all these causes impinging on it. So it looks like we are these free agents, and we're actually not in an ultimate sense. You know, the decisions you make were already made, and science is proving this. Determinism is proving it. However, we judge people as if they had that freedom, and that judgment is based on the very useful illusion that they could have, that you actually could have chosen someone else to marry or another flavor of ice cream or another college to go to. You couldn't have, but we make our moral judgments based on that assumption.
Okay. Well, that's it's an interesting concept. How does it, you know, you have some things that you compare it to or try to make it so that we can all understand it better. Let's do the now, because you, of course, are a pianist and you like music. So tell us about the difference between classical and, I don't know, what is it, jazz?
Yeah, well, I play jazz piano. I can read music. But when we play jazz piano, I play professionally, there's this feeling, there's this gestalt thing that happens. And I think it happens in every art. And I call this harmonic free will. You might want to call it aesthetic free will or poetic free will, whatever, where you're kind of jumping outside of the notes that are written on the page, which is linear, and you're going in a vertical way, and you have this feeling that you're above and beyond, and you're free to create and improvise. And so as a jazz pianist, I'm not saying classical musicians don't create beautiful work, because they do. But when you play jazz, you're improvising, and you own it, and it becomes your own. And just like you, the question you just asked me was not read from a script. You just made it up. We go through life improvising pretty much, although sometimes we read from the score. So free will is a combination of both of those. It's the printed score, which is horizontal, cause and effect, scientific determinism, and it's also the vertical social arrangement we live in, which I call harmonic free will. When you put those two together, we have this beautiful illusion. It doesn't exist in reality. It's not a scientific truth. It's a social truth that allows all of us to say that we actually are free and in control of our own thoughts and decisions, even though we're not.
And how does it relate to happiness? How does free will relate to happiness? If everything is predetermined, how can we overcome these predeterminations?
Yeah, you know, some people are fatalistic about it. Most people are not. Most people, when confronted with the fact that everything's predetermined, we still are what we call compatibilists. We still feel like our decisions are at least going through us. They're not going around us. It's not like we're puppets or something. We all feel like our decisions are going through us. And, in fact, we treat other people the same way. When someone's on trial for a crime, or if we want to give an award to a philanthropist or a hero or somebody who did a wonderful thing, or when you clap when your children take their first steps and do some good things, we are assuming that they have this agency within them. And that feeling of freedom and of owning your own thoughts does contribute to happiness. Otherwise, you'd feel like you were a slave in a cell your whole life, just doing what someone else told you to.
This is a pretty heady concept. I think that most people, I'm not sure if everyone can understand it, but your book is, just came out, right? It's just came out?
Just today.
Oh, wow,
very
good.
First interview.
Okay,
yeah.
So it's the release date. And I think, you know, I'm trying to relate it to writers, how understanding free will could help writers. What do you think?
Well, free will is an illusion, kind of like how depth perception is an illusion. We have two different eyes, and they produce these two images, and our brain creates this thing. Like if you put the glasses on at a 3D movie, you feel like you could reach out and touch something. It's not really there, but it looks like it is. So I think free will is a moral depth perception that our brains create that's not really there, but you feel like you could reach out and touch it. And so we should live our lives as if we had complete freedom. We are not little gods. We are not above nature in some way. But since our decisions are going through us, we should live as if we did have that freedom. And, of course, we do. That's how we treat other people. That's how you treat people who are on trial. That's how we give our verdicts. A verdict may be wrong, but a verdict is a social truth that stands for truth. Free will might be wrong, but free will is a social truth that stands for truth. And so, of course, we all live our lives as if we were free, autonomous agents. And I think we don't have to contradict the scientists. We can just say the scientists are correct. Everything's predetermined, but we're still going to live as if we have free will, and we're going to find that phrase very useful in our lives.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being on today. I'm sorry that I mispronounced your name. I don't know why. You know, I looked at it three times, and I don't know. There must be something to do with, because perhaps I'm just thinking of bakeries. I don't know.
It happens all the time.
I did get your first name right, because my son's name is Dan, so that I was good at.
There you go.
Okay. And, good luck with this book. I think there's depth to it that people will need to sort of put on their thinking caps with this book. But I do think that, I always love to learn something new, and I hadn't really known about this concept here, and so I think it's very interesting, and it's called Free Will Explained.
Thank you, Pat.
Free Will Explained: How Science and Philosophy Converge to Create a Beautiful Illusion, and that's what we hope. At least we hope that our lives will be a beautiful illusion.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much, Dan. Thank you for being on Joy on Paper. Bye bye now. And we're going to go take a commercial break, and we'll come back with Lisa Garten.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Hello, I'm Mike Lindell, inventor of MyPillow. My employees and I would like to thank you for making MyPillow possible. Years ago, when I invented MyPillow, I thought I was the only one out there with problems sleeping. Pillows would go flat, I'd flip-flop all night or wake up with a sore neck or headache. So that's why I invented MyPillow. You can adjust MyPillow's patented fill to your exact individual needs to help you get to sleep faster and stay there longer to get the quality sleep you need. I back it with my 10-year warranty and my 60-day money-back guarantee. And now to thank you, I'm bringing back my best offer ever. Buy one of my MyPillows and get another one absolutely free.
Support Joy on Paper and local authors. Go to MyPillow.com and use promo code PATSY. P-A-T-Z-I.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Is also celebrating the release date of her book. It's the ninth in her series, and I am so excited to be able to talk again to Lisa Garten. She's been on the program before, and she's a fantastic author. So here's Lisa coming up.
Right? Wow, I am so excited to have as a guest today one of my absolute favorite authors, and everybody knows that I've always talk about her books, Lisa Garten. I am so happy to have you on today, Lisa. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much.
Now, you know, Lisa, I was wondering, do you know what the world record is for holding one's breath?
No, I do not.
Well, I will tell you, I think I set the record when I read that prologue. The prologue for the new book, which is called Look For Me, that has to be one of the very best prologues ever written for a thriller book.
Thank you. So I've been telling people, if you go to lisagardner.com, you can read the prologue. Because people have been saying it's like one of the scariest, most intense I don't know, I've written 20-something books. I've kind of lost track. But they're like, no, this one's the most intense.
It is.
Readers can go and figure out.
anybody who does that has to take a stopwatch with you because you can and time yourself, because I couldn't take a breath. I'm reading this prologue and I'm and it was so exciting.
Oh, you know, this is the magic of being a novelist. Even all these years later, I mean, I knew I wanted a kind of attention-grabbing crime scene, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
Because I needed something compelling. But even I didn't know what was going to happen until I sat down and wrote it. And it's always interesting to me, all these years later, it's still magic. You sit down and these things just kind of happen. And then afterwards, people are like, what were you thinking? What were you intending? And I'm like, I'm typing. This is what came out. You know, that's all I got for you. You know?
Well, it is. As I said, I think it's one of the best prologues I've ever read, and everyone will be wondering exactly how did she do it. And I can tell you, once one reads that prologue, first of all, one has to realize that one can hold one's breath for a long time, and then secondly, colors will never be quite the same after you read that prologue.
Yay! Yay!
You achieved it.
Oh, thank you.
Well, I love the use of, I love when people are very descriptive. You know, I had C.J. Box on, and he wrote one passage in his book. He wrote about a guy walking into a bar, and he sees another guy with aluminum hair. Now, nobody ever, you know, describes gray hair as aluminum, but once you think of it, it, you know.
Yeah.
Every time now I'm out in public, and I'm walking around in the grocery store, I saw a guy one day, and I said, that guy's got aluminum hair. I didn't know if I should tell him that.
That's awesome. You know? I like it. Yeah, that's great.
And so you've done the same thing with colors here in this prologue. And I want people to just go and enjoy it because, you know, one of the things I sort of hate about Amazon or any of the places where they give you the opening of the book where they tell you, you know, this is what's going to happen in the first part. So I actually never read those things before I get a book. But, you know, when I get an email saying a certain guest has a book out, sometimes I can't help but read that first paragraph. So I know that it's going to open with a brutal murder. And so it's sometimes disappointing for me because I like to be surprised. But, boy, with this prologue, you surprised me.
I really loved it. And look for me. You know, we're bringing back Flora Dane,
who's
a victim-turned-vigilante. And I wrote the original book for her. I'm not an author who plans. I didn't know I was going to bring her back. But once it became clear, readers love her. I loved her. Like, she has so much more story to tell, I think. She's on this really compelling journey for how do you go from someone, you know, who was kidnapped for a year and a half of your life to figuring out who you are now. But I wanted to introduce her in a really dynamic kind of kick-ass fashion. And that's what I love about the prologue, is you start with this kind of horrific thing, and there's Flora Dane standing there at the end kind of like, and now I'm going to make your whole life better.
Oh,
and it's such an empowering moment.
And Flora Dane is
such a terrible ordeal.
Exactly, and Flora Dane is such a great character. Of course, she was from your book called Find Her, and that book was exciting in itself too. But I think everyone who reads your books when you introduce Flora Dane, we thought, wow, this is a very fascinating character and someone we wanted to know more about. And so it's great that you brought her back for this book.
I love her and Detective Dee Dee Warren together. You know, we have the scenario. An entire family has been murdered. A 16-year-old daughter is missing. Is she the killer? Is she the next victim? I mean, both Flora and Dee Dee have a stake in this. I mean, Flora has an obsession with missing girls, and Roxy Baez is missing. You know, Dee Dee is a homicide detective working a murder case where Roxy may very well actually be the perpetrator. But I think what's more fascinating is they both are intent on justice. They both want to be there for the victim. But, you know, Dee Dee, by definition, is, you know, a bona fide detective. She's going to do things properly. Where Flora is a victim-turned-vigilante. And, you know, if some, you know, child molesters, killers, rapers, perpetrators get, you know, harmed along the way, you know, all the better. You know? So two very different approaches to crime fighting, and I think, you know, it's fun to let readers decide who do they like best, and so far, I gotta say, it's not the buy-the-books model.
Yeah, I think so. There is there's a little bit of Jack Reacher in Flora Dane there. Find the bad guys and let's get rid of them.
There is something about this modern day and age where a vigilante strikes a chord. I think people do feel our real justice system isn't quite getting the job done. And I like Flora. I like her very much. I think she's compelling. This is a woman whose life was kind of interrupted. She went off to college. She was an innocent farm girl from Maine. She had kind of these vague hopes and dreams like any, you know, kid her age. And then she was abducted. And that has become the single most defining event of her life. And who wants to be defined by that? And yet, you have to be. And now everything is you know, post-Jacob next, post-abduction. And that's an awful burden there. And she, on the one hand, wants to shrug it off. She wants to be free, like any survivor would. But on the other hand, that's not terribly realistic. It is the single most defining moment of her life. And this journey she is now on, how do you go from being a survivor to a thriver, is a very real journey. And I think it's compelling. I think we all can kind of identify with someone who is, I don't like who I am now, but I'm not sure who to be next. You know, it's a journey.
And I love the banter between them. I love the relationship between Flora and Dee Dee. And of course, I think we're all so very happy that Dee Dee, you know, although being a detective is the main part of her life, but that she does have another life. I love Jack. I love, you know, it's just so nice. It's so nice to have that.
Again, I think when you write suspense, you have to ground your characters. We love Dee Dee for all the ways she's not us, the readers. You know, she's this larger-than-life, bold, brash, workaholic, homicide detective that's going to do anything and everything to catch her man. And she says all the stuff that most of us are way too polite to say. And she, again, is a little bit, she's just more confident than most of us feel like we can be. And we love that about her. But you have to anchor her again. And what anchors her is her family. And that's a part of her that's compelling. She got domesticated in spite of herself. Like, holy crap, she has a husband. She has a 5-year-old son. And oh my God, now they have a dog. Like a dog.
A dog.
Like, I mean, for Dee Dee, this is just like, how did this happen to me? But at the same time, I mean, she's madly in love with her family. And that's what we relate to. I mean, we're not all larger than life homicide detectives who, you know, can walk these crime scenes, but we do get the juggle of having to balance work and family life. And we do get this notion of there are these things now that are forever tugging at her heart. And, you know, she was someone who wanted to be Teflon. And she will never be Teflon again. She loves her husband, her child, and even the dog, Chico, her now, her like her all-time great nemesis. She can catch any killer on the planet, but Chico, who eats her boots, was, this is now the adversary. You know?
Well, that's I think that's what makes it so, your writing, of course, is so good, but having the nuance that you have in your work. Because I know that as a reader, I'm happy that Dee Dee has some place to go home to. It's not an empty, cold apartment. I know she's going home, and I like that, you know, she has this good husband and a child waiting for her, no matter how terrible her day is. And boy, oh boy, she sees such terrible things. And in this story, there is so much here about... Oh, about the children, the terrible things that are happening in foster care. So it's so good to know that she can go home to some warmth and some joy.
Well, you know, part of Dee Dee for me came out of real-world research. And suspense for years, it was like our detectives were like these lone wolf, dark, edgy, frankly, functional alcoholics. Like that was just your quintessential, you know, whether it was a private investigator or a homicide detective, they were like these, you know, barely emotionally functioning creatures because their job took such a toll on them. And I do tons and tons of research. I have no background myself, but for 25 years now, I have been talking to FBI, Boston, you know, city cops, local cops, county cops, you know, Fish and Game. And I haven't encountered a lone wolf, dark, edgy, functional alcoholic in the mix. I can't tell you how many police officers coach Little League in their free time, and I'm not making that up. In fact, tons of them are coaches in their free time. They have families. And they will be the first to tell you they have a community, and that's what grounds them, is something to come home to at the end of the day. And this, you know, I like to do real-world police procedure, but at a certain point, I was like, this lone wolf, barely functional law enforcement officer, in this day and age of modern policing, that really would be frowned upon. You have to be a wholly functioning, coping individual. And Detective Dee Dee Warren is a much more realistic. She has a really hard job. And she is dedicated to her job because God knows our cops work for service, not because of the compensation. But she comes home to a family that grounds again. And she does have ways of releasing. She has a squad that is her family. This is much more how it is in the real world when I talk to cops. They're not grim at all. In fact, they're very funny. They all have great coping skills, and they adore their family because more so than a lot of us, they understand, you know, what a gift that is.
Exactly, and how quickly it can be lost. And so I think that is why your books are so touching to people who read them. I have some of my listeners who are your fans. So, I mean, they are so like, when is the next book coming out? When is the next book coming out? Because they have this connection with you.
Yeah. And, I mean, I think the prologue for Look For Me, as we've established, it's a little bit like, holy mother. it's shocking.
It is.
But I like to think the books at the end of the day have heart. And Look For Me, it is a story all about family. What happened to this family, the Baez family? We know right away, you know, something terrible happened because, you know, four family members have been shot dead and the fifth is missing. But we also know almost immediately, because the police are good at their job, the mother's an alcoholic. At one point, she bottomed out and the children were removed from her. But she also loved her kids so much. She cleaned up her act and she complied with everything the judge said so she could get her family back. So this is her and her kids living happily ever after, except this terrible thing still happened. So what is really going on with this family? And the only clues we have are the missing 16-year-old has written a series of essays herself trying to work through. What is family? What is the perfect family? What is love? What is forgiveness? I mean, they've kind of done everything wrong, and yet they are a close family that loves each other very much. I mean, I think, again, we can identify with that. We don't always make the right decisions, but it doesn't mean we don't love the people close to us. It's Detective Dee Dee Warren. She has this obsessive job, and she didn't mean to become domesticated, but she wouldn't give up her family in the world. And this heart, I think, it grounds the novel. I think readers come back to it because these are the things we can relate to. Hopefully we're not workaholic detectives or obsessive vigilantes who want to kill people or even a murdered family. But still, we understand what it is at the end of the day to love and yet to not always make the best decisions.
And these essays are beautifully written and that you intersperse in the book. Some of them just bring tears to one's eyes. They are just a beautiful device that you've used to explain about the family and to make all of us really care about them and make them memorable.
I think it's really important in suspense that you care about the characters. I mean, all suspense novels are a crime novel, right? But if you don't end up liking the people, well, then what does it matter who did it or why it happened? I think you have to care. And I'm drawn to ambiguous situations. So in this, like, where you have a whole family murdered and the teenager's missing. In real life, we really don't have an answer to that. Half of the time, it will be the teenager was involved in the murder of her own family. You know, an evil boyfriend, drugs, whatever. But the other half of the time, she is the next victim. The family was murdered just to kidnap her. And those kinds of situations, you know, a family that was whole, but then became fractured, but then became whole again. But what's really going on? Those are situations. It's like a series of questions. And that is what gets me going as a writer, because I don't know the answers. For this entire book, I wrote the book so I could figure out what was going on with the Baez family. Who is Roxy? What did happen to her and her family? I mean, I did not know until the bitter end.
Well, it is a beautiful book. And, you know, from the point of view of the writing, you are so talented. And my listeners are always interested in knowing, you know, did you ever receive a rejection letter? When they read a book like yours, which is so fine-tuned and everything is perfect, they'll say to me, oh, well, she doesn't know. She's never been rejected.
I don't know an author out there that has not been rejected. So my story is intriguing. It's like, what are the nuances of rejection? I was fortunate in that you could say my first book sold. But it sold accompanied with a 20-page single-spaced revision letter. So I'm like, did the story sell, or did the names of the characters and everything else was changed? to this day, for a novel like Look For Me, my writing process is I research with law enforcement for 3 months because I think it's very important to have real-world procedure. I mean, it's a fictional crime, but what would we really do? And I want to have the cast of details right and family court details right. You know, that kind of stuff I think matters. I draft the book in 6 months, which makes me sound like I'm really smart. But to tell you the truth, I don't know who did it. I don't know what we're writing to. The book at the end is kind of a hot mess. And to this day, 25 years later, I did 3 months of very intense revision work. You know, entire chapters were tossed, new things were written, things were tightened up. Writing is work. And for all aspiring writers out there, you're going to get rejection letters, you're going to get editorial letters, and it's your ability to learn and to keep learning. I mean, when people say your books are still good, it's like, well, I'm still trying. I mean, I do an incredible amount of revision work because I want the book to be the best possible, and I respect my editors. They're the independent judges, and when they say this doesn't work and that doesn't work, I eat a lot of brownies and I suck it up. I go back to the drawing board, you know?
Well, I want to thank you so much for being on today, because it's a joy to talk to you. And you certainly have discovered the joy, even though you write horrific, horrific stories. And you know, whether it was, this opening or some of the other openings in your book says sometimes you really are you know, we have to take a really deep breath. But I want to thank you so much for being on the program today. And the new book by Lisa Gardner is, as I said, it is a whopper, if you ask me. And it's called Look For Me. And Lisa, I want to thank you so much for being on the program today.
Well, thank you so much, Patsy. And I'm so glad you enjoyed the novel. And yes, Look For Me is available. And people can check out the prologue in question that we keep talking about at lisagardner.com.
And the rest of the book will also keep you, you know, just turning the pages, because it is very exciting. And lots of twists and turns that were, even for me, you know, and I'm used to reading all, I'm saying, oh boy, she's come out with this. She's come out with this idea. I like that. I just love all that twists and turns.
That's what I love to hear. I think in good suspense, you have to keep people guessing. So thank you.
And you certainly do. You keep us all guessing right to the end. And again, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. Lisa Gardner. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Isn't she cute? I think she's so cute. So I do hope you'll get this book. As I said, go to her website, read the prologue. It's a quite an amazing bit of writing. And now I am so happy that I am able to welcome back onto the program someone who it changed my life because I never knew anything about football until I talked to him. So I am so happy to have back on the program Bob Slowick, who is known as Coach Slow. He was here to talk about his book, 60 Minutes to a Lifetime, Lessons I've Learned About Life and Football from My NFL Coaching Career. Bob, are you there?
Yes, I am, Patsy. Great to be here again.
Okay, well, you know, I was thinking about you on Sunday because, as you know, when I talked to you before about your book, I had always thought X's and O's meant hugs and kisses, and then your book enlightened me. And I learned all sorts of things about football that I never knew. And one of the things, of course, was I had no idea that they actually planned out all of these moves before they go there on the field. So I found it so much fun to look at my first, very, very first Super Bowl game.
Well, that is fantastic, and I'm glad that the game of football has another new fan. And you were not incorrect in one regard, in that after the Super Bowl, at least for one team, the Philadelphia Eagles, it did mean hugs and kisses because that was quite an accomplishment for them. So I'm sure there was plenty of that going around, and it was an exciting game. And I was fortunate, Patsy, at one time to be involved as a coach in a Super Bowl, and we happened to win that game as well. So I know the feeling very well.
Well, which game was that? Because I don't know all these Super Bowls. So which one were you involved in?
Oh, gosh, now I have to put an age to myself. It was way back in 1992 with the Dallas Cowboys, and we won the Super Bowl when we played the Buffalo Bills. And I know that whichever team wins, whether would have been the New England Patriots, or in this case, the Philadelphia Eagles. At the end of the game, once they had won the game, they had a feeling of nothing but pure, pure joy. And joy being the passion or emotion excited by the acquisition of good, meaning that they knew they were the best, at least for this year, and maybe they could be the best again.
Well, as I said, I had never understood anything about football. And because of the little stories that you have in your book, and I really have a new appreciation for really the work that goes into planning a game and how much the players have to know. I didn't know that they actually memorized all these books and pages and stuff. When I think about it, I just really did think they just ran out there and did their thing and went whichever way the ball was going.
Exactly. No, it's very well choreographed, though. They do. Everything is very, very detailed. And, Patsy, one thing about the head coach of the Philadelphia Eagles that I want to make a point of, because I thought he did a tremendous job leading his team, because they lost their starting quarterback early in the season. And through his leadership and his confidence in the team, the backup quarterback, they go on to win the game, the Super Bowl. And he said after the game, he said, which was really quite a point, he said, an individual can make a difference, but a team can make miracles. And how true that is. We can do so much more together than we ever could alone.
Well, I think your book is very inspirational. And there were so many stories, and I didn't get it. Chance to ask you about all of them, but as you know, I am a baseball fan, and I have been going to baseball games since I was a wee little thing, and I love baseball. So I wanted you to tell that story about your sons and the baseball.
Oh, that's a great one. Yes. Well, I played baseball as a youngster as well, and all my three boys did too. So they're getting ready to prepare for their season, so to speak, at a young age. I think it was 7, 8, and my oldest at that time was 14. We go to the batting cages. You put the token into the, of course, machine, and you get 15 pitches, and my oldest son goes in there, goes into the cage and puts his money in, gets 15 pitches, and it was like he never skipped a beat. Bam, bam, he's hitting the ball really well. And then the middle son, he goes in, and he's 8 years old at the time. He puts his token in, and he's not quite as good, obviously, a little younger, but he's making contact almost on every pitch. So here comes the youngster, the seven-year-old, and he goes in there after watching his two older brothers, puts his coin in, and here comes the first pitch, and it's a whiff, whiff, whiff. I mean, he is not even close. He's not, and so 15 pitches, 15 whiffs. Tears are flowing, you know, and as the dad, you're just suffering through each and every one. And it's painful. So one more round, they go through. Same thing with the older guys. They're hitting away, doing well. The younger one goes back in, 15 more whiffs. And then go home, still tears, cries all the way home, gets up the next day. I get home from work. They say, let's go to the batting cages again. Okay. I'm thinking, oh good. Steve is the youngest one. He's not around. So we start to go out the door. Oh, he shows up around the corner. Hey, Dad, can I go? Sure. Okay, come on. And I'm just thinking, oh, gosh, here we go. 15 more pitches, all whiffs and tears flowing. So there we go. The two older ones, same thing. They're hitting away. My youngest one goes in there, and I'm just, like, dreading it. First pitch, bam, hits one right down the middle. Then he hits, he probably was 75%. But, oh, what a smile. High fives all around. And the moral to the story is it didn't look like he was making any progress with whiff after whiff, but he was making progress, and sometimes you just can't see it. So he was getting trained, his eyes, his timing, and, of course, his persistence. And next day, there it was, hit after hit.
Well, that's why I wanted you back on, Coach Slow, because I think that story's inspirational, and as are so many of the stories in your book. And as you said, that same kind of determination and finding the joy in what you are doing goes across the spectrum of jobs. It doesn't, not just for football, not just for sports, for writers, for everybody. And I think you're a very inspirational person. I do hope that people will not riot anymore after a game, because there's no need for that nonsense. But
so true.
Yeah, that's so ridiculous. And I, having lived in England for a long time, where we had, they really would be quite horrible. I hope that perhaps people will look at it again now and say, we don't need to do that. There's, you know, you can be celebrating, but you don't have to destroy property. So after your game in Dallas, your big win, did everybody riot there and break things and turn cars upside down?
You know what? I don't remember. I don't believe so. But I was so beyond that part of it that it's hard for me even to fathom what would inspire someone to do such a thing in a celebratory manner. That just, I agree with you. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. I just don't understand it.
Well, I do hope that people will get your book. Again, I want to tell everybody the title of it, 60 Minutes to a Lifetime, Lessons I've Learned About Life and Football from My NFL Coaching Career. And Bob Slowick, I think you are really inspirational, and I hope that you are able to get out there and talk to a lot of groups and inspire both adults and kids.
Well, thanks, Patsy. It was great talking to you again.
Okay. And X's and O's to you. I'll just give you hugs and kisses. Okay. Thanks so much.
Indeed.
For joining. Okay.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Bye now. Bye. Oh, that's cute. I like him. It's so funny. I did fall asleep. I will admit I didn't finish the game, but I did watch the beginning and I did watch, and I was watching and I was trying to imagine what it was like, what all those play sheets are and where the X's and the O's are. And so it really adds, for anyone who doesn't know anything about football, the book is really helpful. And then, of course, all of you people who love football and know all the, you know, really are interested, his take on what it means to prepare for a game is really fascinating. And I'm sure you will like it. And as I said, he's just inspirational because he believes in finding joy
And he uses that word a lot. It was funny. One of the reasons that I enjoyed the book is that he uses that word, and he actually lectures or talks, you know, in his pep talks before a game. He would talk to them about finding joy in the game. And so that's what I'm always talking to all of you about, is finding joy on paper. Because remember, you know, one of the most wonderful things in life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book. And I am getting more and more fond of audible books. So the next thing, of course, is hearing your words on stage or screen. But I do want to warn all of you people out there, please, please check out my website next week, because I'm going to have some talk there about falling for people who are trying to get you to take your book and turn it into a movie. It's not that easy, and do not spend a lot of your money on things that will not work. As Dave Chesson from Kindlepreneur said, you have to focus. You have to not be just playing around with things. You have to focus. And if you want to sell more books, you have to be a very focused person. And I will also have next week on my website a business plan for you to start following, so that you can promote your books in a logical and intelligent fashion and get the most bang for your buck, because you do have to invest. You do have to think that selling books is a business, but you also have to be smart, just like you, if you were running any business. So next week I will have that. But meanwhile, if you would please go to my Facebook page and like me, and I'll like you, but I probably won't message with you, because my goodness, I started this Facebook thing at the beginning of the year, and I've got like 1,000 people wanting me to message with them. I could spend all day on Facebook. Unfortunately, I don't have time, because I have a lot of books to read. Oh, and I do want to say, we have a great new friend in Sarah Jessica Parker. Did you realize she has become an editor at Hogarth? And she is looking for great books. And so I hope to have her and one of the authors that she is bringing out in May. And I hope to have Sarah Jessica Parker here on Joy on Paper. Wouldn't that be wonderful? Because she's a friend to everybody, I guess, in the world. Everybody knows her. And it's amazing just to think about it. So what I was going to say, I have to say hi to Big Ed in the control. He negotiated all of these three guests today, and he saluted me, and I salute him, because he always does everything for me, and he puts up my sign, and he smiles, and he helps me get organized. And I just want to thank everybody for being here today, and I've got some really great guests coming up, and let's talk soon, okay? Bye.